This is On the Media. I'm Leah Fetter on the struggle for Poland's past and future. Before the anti-liberal right, there was liberal democracy, which took hold in Poland formally in the summer of 1989.
Poland appeared today on the verge of having a non-communist government. President Wojciech Jaruzelski met with Solidarity leader Lech Walesa.
A few years later, after the collapse of the Soviet bloc, political scientist Francis Fukuyama wrote a famous book called The End of History and the Last Man.
The end of history refers to what I think still remains a question of whether that process is one that, you know, finally culminates in a certain kind of civilization.
Fukuyama on C-SPAN in 2001.
You know, the last civilization that mankind will achieve, because in a certain sense it's the, you know, it's the right one, it's the one that fits human nature. What I argue in the book is that liberal democracy comes much closer to fitting human nature in that sense than virtually any type of prior form of government or political organization or social organization.
It was a seductive idea that liberal democracy, which embraces human rights and equal protection along with popular representation, was humanity's natural landing point. But it's been severely challenged by the rise of illiberalism, a mindset that sees democracy as possible without those freedoms and protections. Democracy, in this view, is a winner-take-all game in which minority rights are subordinate and subject to the will of the majority. It restyles the, quote, will of the people into something fierce, absolutist, and it's a rising trend. Fareed Zakaria.
These two traditions, liberty and law on the one hand and popular participation on the other, became intertwined, creating what we call liberal democracy. In a number of countries, from Hungary to Russia to Turkey to Iraq to the Philippines, the two strands have come apart. Democracy persists in many cases, but liberty is under siege.
In Poland, the past 4 years, the Liberal Law and Justice Party has subdued its judicial opponents and gained increasing control over the courts. It's enacted harsh measures against immigrants and the LGBT community. In 2016, it tried for a complete ban on abortion, but backed down after a wave of strikes. It's turned the state TV network into a party mouthpiece and become increasingly enmeshed with the Catholic Church. But it's also done something else.
They have used economics.
Anne Applebaum.
Poland went from having one of the smaller welfare states in Europe to having it's either the largest or one of the top two or three as a proportion of GDP. They basically created a welfare state, and for people in the provinces, it was so generous that about 1 million people left the labor market altogether. It was a big economic giveaway.
The kind of giveaway usually associated with social democrats. Political analysts credit the success of law and justice to a secret sauce of xenophobia, nationalism, and those economic policies. Meanwhile, the battle for the future of Poland raged last summer in Warsaw, giving birth to a new left-wing political coalition.
Whoa!
Lewica, Polish for left, allied Poland's three left-wing parties, Razem, SLD, and Spring. Until recently, they've been mostly on the fringes of a Polish political landscape divided between the far-right Law and Justice Party and the center-right Civic Platform. I went to Lewica's inaugural rally with Igor Stofiszewski, a literary critic and activist with the left-wing publication and network Krytyka Polityczna. A slight man with a shaved head in his 40s, he walked me by some buildings claimed by squatters in downtown Warsaw, occupied by a mix of locals and immigrants. We pass a poster with the face of an older woman named Jolanta Breszka, an activist murdered in 2012, now a symbol of the housing movement in Warsaw.
At that time,
Igor says the city is plastered with them. Warsaw is a city with symbols of resistance throughout. A theater with the words feminism, not fascism, spray-painted across its marquee. And a mayor who's openly opposed to Law and Justice's central government.
He signed so-called LGBT charter, which proposes very concrete solutions for LGBT community to feel safe, and so on, so on.
The traffic got very loud here, but what he told me was that during the last round of municipal elections in October 2018, the opposition trounced Law and Justice. Turnout was up almost 20%, and although the ruling party made gains in rural areas, it won just 4 of the 107 mayoral races. It's a curious thing, this divide. On one hand, nationalism is on the rise, as evident at this month's annual Independence March, where tens of thousands of Poles took to the streets, and organizers chanted, "Glory to great Poland and God, honor and homeland," from the stage. So is homophobia, evidenced when thousands of anti-gay protesters attacked this summer's LGBT Pride March in Bialystok. On the other hand, the October parliamentary elections failed to deliver Law and Justice a consolidated victory. Yes, the party retained national control, but it not only failed to achieve a constitutional majority, it lost the upper house of parliament, thus losing the ability to pass new laws. Lewica, the left-wing coalition, went from having no representatives in parliament to having 45. Here's Jarosław Kuis, editor-in-chief of the centrist media think tank Kultura Liberalna.
We have quite a new political narrative now that seems to be more pluralistic than for the last 4 years, when we had only the opposition that was mainly from the camp of the previous government, more or less center-right, and the conservative nationalist right from the Law and Justice. So now it is more colorful.
Kuis gives some of the credit to the activism of the Polish opposition. But there's something else afoot. Right before the elections, Krytyka Polityczna and a couple other organizations released a study called Political Cynicism, the Case of Poland, which found that Law and Justice voters are not entirely aligned behind the idea of an unchecked majority for their party. After the elections, I checked back in with Igor, who explained that these voters are likely responsible for Law and Justice's electoral setbacks.
They have more trust in political pluralism than in their own party. So it is not the opposition or the oppositional voter who stopped Law and Justice from having a constitutional majority. It's a Law and Justice voter who stopped them.
Turns out that Law and Justice voters, like all voters, vary in the whys and wherefores of their party affiliation. The so-called old Law and Justice electorate, the hardliners, may be motivated by their loathing for intellectuals, Europe, and urban elites. But the new Law and Justice voters, those whose votes decided this election, are largely in it for the money, especially the government's ever-expanding child benefit. And in the run-up to the most recent election, yet more.
They announced they would distribute an extra month's pension, a kind of so-called 13th month, to all pensioners.
Ann Applebaum.
In the end, they got about 43% of the vote, of which I'd say about half is still true believers and half are people who liked the spending policy.
But obviously, these popular, populist policies come at a price.
I mean, it's come at the cost of investment. They've stopped investing in roads. They've stopped investing in the healthcare system. They're raising taxes.
All of which calls into question how long this particular strategy will continue to pay off. Law and Justice voters are transactional, and transactional voters can shift for a better deal or a better story. The illiberal narrative seized and shaped by Law and Justice of exceptionalism and cultural encroachment, much like America's current White House story, has served it well. What's an effective liberal response?
Maybe we should talk about the last 30 years as the process of ups and downs, because it would be less mythical.
Jarosław Kuis is describing history not as the unvarnished glory of liberal democracy, but as an ongoing effort to gain and retain freedom.
We have the first generations of Poles that were born and brought up in their own independent state. Something like this did not happen since 18th century. If something is to be celebrated, it is that, I think. Now, you have a lot of young citizens that do not remember communism.
I know that the communist past has been manipulated in a lot of different ways, and particularly the anti-communist sentiment. I'm wondering if you think there's value in actually reclaiming some of that communist past.
I tend to think, after all those experiments with political history, that we should remember more. Mm-hmm. That it was a political mistake of liberals to leave the historical issues to the right. What could be the solution is to rather to teach how complex Polish history in the 20th century was and how it ended up eventually with this wonderful event of entering the European Union. And we should start to teach it to the new generations as a history that is very complex one. And then maybe we could have some conclusions for the future.
I mean, I would not say that we're definitely heading for authoritarianism.
Anne Applebaum.
Nor would I say that liberal democracy has won and we'll definitely beat this thing off and it'll be fine. I mean, this I think is now what politics is. The assumption that we had finished with those arguments and that we'd all learned the lessons of the Second World War or whatever piece of history you want to point to was wrong.
So now we enter the stage in which we have a kind of permanent battle and skirmishes one after another. It's not going to be the war that would be over here or there. It's like, okay, so these elections were won by illiberals, but we should hope and work for the future, and we should win next elections.
It was foolish to think a generation ago that we were at the end of history, and it would be equally foolish to think that the story is done now. In Poland, as in the United States, history is being wielded in service of opposing visions of the future. And the question of who will inherit the future, that comes down to who's willing to fight for it and what stories they tell. For On the Media, I'm Leah Fetter.
Next week, we return to American shores, where illiberalism has overtaken the Reagan-era coalition of tax cutters and foreign policy hawks, social conservatives and libertarians that made up the conservative movement. Here's a taste of my talk with Commonweal's Matthew Sitman, who's followed the debate on the American right. He says newly empowered illiberals declare that old consensus dead, and though they lack its big numbers, they don't think numbers matter anymore.
You don't see any of these intellectuals really appealing to democracy. They think they're entitled to power, but they also are not grappling with the fact that they might not really have a majority behind them.
There hasn't been a poll taken that suggests that they do.
Right. So we know Trump won 3 million fewer votes than Hillary Clinton. We know that due to gerrymandering and assaults on voting rights, Republicans have more representation in Congress than they should based on the amount of support they have. We know that our political institutions are fairly undemocratic, especially the Senate and the Electoral College. You can see a situation arising in which Republicans keep trying to hold on to power despite not being a majority. And my concern is that these conservative intellectuals are creating the conditions or giving themselves permission to go along with what amounts to authoritarian rule by a political party that doesn't have anywhere close to the support of a majority of Americans.
You quoted from Damon Linker. When social conservatives thought that they were the moral majority, it made sense for them to dream of exercising real political power. When they recognized that they were a minority, it made sense for them to resign themselves to adopting a defensive posture and preparing to live out their days in a country as dissenters from the reigning liberal consensus. What makes no sense is for social conservatives to think that they can be both weak and strong at the same time, a minority that wields the power of a majority. Unless, of course, social conservatives no longer care about democracy.
He put it very well, that the key is to implement the highest good, and the ways you get there matter less.
Next week, the rest of that conversation. This week's show was reported and produced by Leah Fetter. On the Media is also produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Micah Loewinger, John Hanrahan, and Asta Chaturvedi. We had more help from Charlotte Gartenberg, and our show was edited by me and Katya. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Sam Baer. Special thanks to WNYC archivist Andy Lancet, as well as Wojciech Olekshak and Victor Dinarski. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.
WNYC Studios is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, They are one of the largest recipients of NIH funding. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the cancer drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has been making one advanced cancer discovery after another for over 75 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.